coming up on Philosophy Talk.
The president does believe that, and he continues to maintain that belief based on studies and evidence that people have presented to him.
Everyone believes some false things. You probably can't help it.
So have the beliefs that get you what you want.
As I said, I think the president has believed that for a while based on studies and information he has.
Would you rather your beliefs were true but lacking evidence? Or false but held with good reason?
Come on, I bet you have 50 useful false beliefs a day and 50 useless true beliefs a day.
Is it possible to believe something but not care if it's true or false?
It's a belief he maintains.
What is the goal of belief? To make you feel better? To make you more successful? Or to track the truth?
Our guest is Ray Briggs from Stanford University. Should beliefs aim at truth?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Should your beliefs aim at truth?
Or should you just believe whatever makes your life better?
But could false beliefs ever make your life better?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Josh Landy, sitting in for John Perry, who's taking a well-deserved break.
We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy, and I teach comp lit and co-direct the initiative in literature and philosophy.
So Josh, you've been our guest on the show a lot of times, five, six, four, five, I don't know. But how does it feel to be on the other side of the mic, so to speak?
A little bit terrifying, to be honest with you, but exciting. But mostly terrified.
Oh, come on, John. I've never seen you terrified at all. I don't believe it. You're gonna do famously. So today we're asking, should beliefs aim at truth?
Well, yeah, sure, Ken, sometimes. But sometimes it's better to get it wrong.
Oh, come on, Josh. You're kidding, right?
No. Look, say you're about to compete in a race, and you look over, and in the lane next to you is Usain Bolt. But you say to yourself, you know what? I can take that guy. I can win this race.
You mean like I'm like completely deluded, right?
You know, okay, you know, in a way, yeah, it might seem a bit silly to believe you're going to beat Usain Bolt, but believing that's going to make you run faster than you would have otherwise.
I don't know, Josh. I don't think I buy that.
Why not?
Well, I think there may be something going on in your example, but I think it has to do with feeling confident. I mean, not believing falsehoods. Lacking confidence makes you feel nervous and distracted. When you feel confident, you're focused, you're determined. Confident people don't self-sabotage. That's what's going on there.
Maybe. All right, but take a different example. I bet it makes you happy to know that your friends like you.
Well, yes, of course. That's what friends are for.
Okay, well, okay. Now suppose that your friends secretly despised you. Would you want to know that?
Gosh, Josh, that's a depressing thought.
That's my point. Sometimes the truth just isn't worth knowing if it's just going to depress you.
Well, but jeepers, if it really were the case that my so-called friends secretly despise me, I would want to know that no matter how depressing it might be.
Why would you want to know a thing like that?
Well, because it's the truth, Josh.
Okay, but why is the truth the most important thing?
Because otherwise you'd be living a lie, walking around in a state of delusion and confusion.
Well, okay, so maybe you don't want to live a lie. Fair enough. But isn't a little deception sometimes a good thing?
No, I wouldn't say so. Look, Josh, believing something is taking it to be true. I mean, that means truth is very part of the, it's tied up with the very nature of belief. Try saying, I believe I'm in the studio, but it's not true. That doesn't even make sense.
Maybe not to you philosophers, but hey, to us ordinary folk, the point of having beliefs is to make our lives better. You know, it's to help us achieve our goals. I mean, why think that always facing up to the truth is going to be the best way to do that?
Well, come on. I want a cup of coffee. There's a cup of coffee to my right. I believe it's to my left. I reach to the left. Ooh, no coffee. If I don't have true beliefs, I'm going to take misguided action. I'm going to have a lot of frustrated desires.
Well, maybe that holds for coffee cups. But let's go back to the example of the race. Surely winning is a desire you have. You want to win the race, right? But you're just going to have a better chance of winning if you believe you're a better athlete than you actually are.
Well, even if I were to grant that, I think it's just a lucky accident. I mean, believing falsehoods, surely you're not saying that believing false things is a reliable way to get what you want in life. I mean, mostly you need a realistic picture of what you need to do, what actions you need to take if you're going to succeed in getting what you want on the basis of what you believe. I mean, sure, maybe you'll get lucky once in a while. It's a shot in the dark, but it's not a reliable thing.
Yeah, but surely too much reality isn't a good thing either. I mean, if I only believe true things, I don't even know if I'd get out of bed in the morning. I think I'd be too depressed.
Josh, suppose you're staring the truth in the face, and it would be more comforting to believe something false. I don't think I can make myself do it, no matter how hard I try. The truth just grabs you sometimes.
I think you philosophers need to read more Shakespeare. One of his sonnets begins, "When my love swears that she is made of truth, I do believe her, though I know she lies."
Oh, you literary guys, you just got way too much tolerance for this contradictory belief stuff, man.
Well, before we get too deep into the question of how beliefs should work, maybe we ought to figure out how they do work. We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal, to ask a scientist, how do beliefs form in the brain? She files this report.
What are some of the first beliefs you form as a child? Big is important, small is not. Up is more, down is less. Light is good, dark is evil. Cognitive linguist George Lakoff says each of these come from the physical experience of having a body in the world. Take this one. Cold is mean and warm is affectionate.
You're held by your parents affectionately. You're held against their bodies. You feel their temperature, their warmth. So what you have is temperature, warmth, and affection activated over and over and over again.
Until warm means affectionate. Lakoff calls these kinds of beliefs metaphors.
There are thousands of unconscious metaphorical thoughts that we have and metaphors that we use to understand the world. And more is up, less is down.
A repeated physical experience gives us our understanding of an abstract concept. For example, scary things happen when you can't see, so evil is linked to darkness. Over time, our experience gives us more complex and less universal beliefs, and hopefully we come up with a better definition of evil. Lakoff argues that even complicated things like politics originate in our experience of our household as children. If we're raised in what he calls a strict father home, conservative politics will make more sense to us. If we're raised in a nurturing parent home, progressive politics will be more consistent with our worldview.
That doesn't mean you don't rebel against it. It doesn't mean you don't have peer pressure from the outside. It doesn't mean you don't have other reasons not to do it. So it's not 100% predictable, but it has a major influence.
We connect things that our experience tells us go together, like rules equals security, compromise equals losing, creating circuits that make up a network, a worldview.
Circuits that fire a lot get stronger. Well, when they become part of your everyday life, they're firing all the time, constantly. And they're firing in such a way that they fit together.
And it's easier to notice and remember the things that fit together easily. Some psychologists call this confirmation bias. Lakoff goes further. He says it's almost impossible to incorporate ideas that don't already use the building blocks of our worldview.
Ideas don't float in the air. They're in your neural circuitry. You can't have any ideas without your brain doing it.
Imagine hundreds of thousands of springs holding each other together in an intricate structure.
And you say, okay, can I change this spring while keeping it connected? No. You know, it's going to move this other spring. The other spring will move against it. These other guys will try to reinforce it.
You might be thinking, but I learn new ideas all the time. Well, Lakoff says you might consciously comprehend something, but beliefs are deeper. They're the ideas you don't even know you have, the springs. And unfortunately, they're what really motivate the way you act.
Most decisions are made before you know you've made them. And then you rationalize them afterwards.
So what happens when you're confronted with something that's inconsistent with your worldview? You've got five options.
You can not notice it.
All this time, that's what I've been missing.
You can ignore it.
I'm not listening.
You can unconsciously, your brain can change it to fit.
He couldn't have.
Of course he could.
You can ridicule it.
That's the most ridiculous thing I ever heard.
Or you can attack it if you find it threatening.
It's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
You may be searching for truth in this world, but your brain just wants stability and coherence. But put all those brains on the planet together, and it turns out coherence is the farthest thing from what we've got. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks, Liza, for that journey through the wonders of the mind-brain. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is my Stanford colleague, Joshua Landy, and today we're asking, should beliefs aim at truth?
We're joined now by Ray Briggs, professor of philosophy at Stanford University. Ray, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. Hi.
So, Ray, you're both a poet and a philosopher, so I wonder, what got you interested in the connection between belief and truth? Was it the muse of poetry or the muse of philosophy?
Closer to the muse of philosophy. So I'm the type of nerd who gets really upset when I think people are getting things wrong. Like, I will, if somebody is wrong on the internet, I will correct them very, very patiently and for much longer than is really worthwhile sometimes. And so one of the things I wonder about myself is, like, am I right to get upset when people are wrong? And, like, how upset should I be? And maybe I've got it wrong.
Right. I mean, so we just heard from the roving philosophical reporter that people just aren't very good at getting it right about things. I mean, are you, you know, when you're patiently correcting people on the internet, are you expecting too much of them?
To some degree, I think yes. Although I do think that people can do better than they in fact do. So I get things wrong all the time too. And when I do, I like to sort of be corrected and do better next time. So the fact that, I don't know, you make a mistake once doesn't mean that you're going to keep making the mistake or that you have to.
Well, depends on who you are. I mean, I make a lot of mistakes. You know, I have lots of resolutions, like I want to exercise and all that sort of stuff. And I get in these intense bouts where I exercise all the time and then I get really busy and I don't. I still think I should, but I don't. Now, I want to ask you a factual question. Do our beliefs aim at truth? I mean, maybe Ken should exercise, but does he exercise? So does our brain aim at the truth?
I think some of the time. So actually, I think the stuff in the Roving Philosophical Report doesn't contradict the idea that our beliefs are aiming at the truth, although it does contradict the idea that our beliefs are always achieving the truth.
So what do you mean? It seems to lead us to expect that there'll be lots and lots of false beliefs in the brain. So whatever it's doing, whatever it's aiming at, it's certainly producing lots of false beliefs.
Yeah, I think that's right. But you could see that as making mistakes on the way to getting at the truth. So take the warmth equals love and friendliness metaphor. So if every time that I'm warm when I'm a child, I get love and friendliness from my parents, then getting warm is a good signal that I'm going to get love and friendliness again. Now, it's not a perfect signal. And so I might try to distinguish, like, the times when I'm going to get warm and get love and friendliness and the times when I'm getting warm because, like, the sun is out and it's just hot.
Yeah, I mean, presumably there are some things we get right. I mean, you know, so I teach in a literature department, and, mm-hmm. and some of my colleagues get very excited about these cognitive biases and say, well, you know, Josh, what you have to know is our beliefs, all our memories are just completely made up. And I'm like, how did you get my name right?
Yes.
Is that some kind of miracle? So are there things, that, you know, sort of everyday things that we absolutely have to, it's vital we get them right, and so that shows that, in fact, we're not getting everything wrong?
I think yes. So I know that there's food in my refrigerator. If I didn't know that, I'd probably starve. I know how to get to my job. I know that if I go to my job, then I'll get money and I can put more food in my refrigerator. And that all seems pretty important to my survival.
Yeah, it's certainly true. I mean, if we aimed at the false, if we believed only false things, that would be really bad for us. No doubt about that. Even Josh's comforting illusions, that would be really bad. But it's not clear to me that we aim at the truth, or if we do aim at the truth, we're pretty poor shots, because the mix of the true and the false in the human brain is astounding. That's what strikes me, that there's a mixture of the true and the false. In some domains, we might be pretty reliable, and in some domains, we're just crap.
Yeah, I think that we definitely don't always hit the truth, even if we're always aiming at it. I don't think we always are aiming at it, but I think we always should be aiming at it.
So these are complicated things, and we'll have to dig into the difference between the sort of norms and facts. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about beliefs and truth with Ray Briggs from Stanford University.
Is it always good to face the cold, hard facts? Or can a little positive illusion help you get through the day?
Truth, belief, and illusion. When Philosophy Talk continues. I don't even know if I believe. I don't even know if I believe everything you're trying to say to me. When you don't know what to believe, is truth always the best thing to aim for? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, sitting in for John Perry, and we're asking whether beliefs should aim at the truth. Our guest is Ray Briggs from Stanford University.
So I want to go back to Josh's example from the opening. I want to know what you think of this kind of category of, you know, thinking that you can beat Usain Bolt in a race. He gave that as an example of a false belief, but a useful false belief. Do you like the category of useful false beliefs?
I think I have to believe in useful false beliefs because that example was very good. Probably some religious and political beliefs. So not everybody's religious beliefs can be true, although I'm not going to make a judgment about whose are and whose
aren't. I will, but you don't have to.
Right. Not on the air. So many people must have false religious beliefs, but it can be really useful to have those beliefs if everybody in your community believes them and if they let you get in good with everybody in your community.
Wait a minute then. Why then is truth the aim? It should be useful beliefs that would be the aim of believing, and that will be a mix of the true and the false.
Sometimes
it's useful to believe the truth. Sometimes it's useful to believe the false thing. Well, what about that?
No, I think that's a little quick.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
So tell me why.
So,
I meant it to be quick.
Good. So having a useful false belief is kind of missing the point of belief. So I think that belief has a point that is not just about its usefulness, the way lots of other things have a point. So humor has a point. It's not just about its usefulness. And if I have a powerful, unfunny person telling jokes and I laugh at the jokes, I might have done something useful, but that doesn't make them funny and that doesn't make them achieve their point as humor.
Wait a minute, but wait, go back to, I don't want to speak for Josh, but I will, even though I don't want to. And he can correct me if I'm wrong. His pal Nietzsche, right, used to rail against people who had a fetish for truth. What is the point of a belief in an overall human life? It's to support one's projects, to be the ground on which one stands. So these useful political beliefs, these useful religious beliefs, they make a life possible. The belief isn't just like to mirror the world, it's to support you in the world. What about that thought?
So I think sometimes it's okay to miss the point. Like, you know, if, so philosophers like to have these examples where I'm offered like large sums of money to believe a contradiction. And I'm not even sure that it's, you know, maybe I should if I could and I can't. So it's a bit pointless. So I think maybe you should take
I'll definitely take that money. I believe, what is it, six contradictory things before breakfast?
Right.
I'm curious about, I mean, so it's interesting. You might think, well, certain political beliefs, they might be bad things to hold if they're wrong. Mm-hmm. But there might be other cases where it seems pretty innocuous, maybe even a good thing. So when I think about, well, Ken's example of exercise, I'm almost certainly a worse exerciser than Ken at his worst. But when I'm doing it, I find it useful to tell myself sort of consoling or encouraging lies, like, this is really the last one. This is really the last one. These seem to be very effective sort of motivation tools. They're not true beliefs. I need to sort of believe them. Well, you know, are there kinds of self-deception that are okay and valuable and kinds that aren't?
Right. So I think that self-deception can be sort of, you know, instrumentally valuable. Like, it can get you things that you want, but still have this problem with it, which is that you're lying to yourself and so you're missing the point of belief. And one thing you might ask yourself is whether you can get the valuable thing that you would have got by self-deception by some other means.
And what if the answer is no?
If the answer is no, then, you know, maybe. So I'm not going to say that in all cases you do the wrong thing by achieving the aim of belief rather than one of your other aims.
So I want to ask you, okay, I'll ask you a slightly skeptical question just because that's my role, right? Mm-hmm. A slightly skeptical question. I look at the brain. I look mm-hmm. at the mind working. I look at cognition in the wild, mm-hmm. as it were. People on the ground forming their beliefs. I notice, well, yeah, they believe all kinds of true things. They believe all kinds of false things. I think, why, where does that mixture come from? I say, well, because they're aiming at kind of utility or something like that. And sometimes the utility is with the false. Sometimes, like, they'll have a hair trigger, right? Mm-hmm. They're hunting around and they're mm-hmm. a little weak thing. And if the tiger's there, so they'll have a hair trigger. Any sound they'll take as a as the presence of the tiger. Mm-hmm. So they got a hair trigger. Sometimes they can slow down and cognize because that's when there's not a danger. So if I look at the brain, the mind in the wild, I find that it has all kinds of aims, survival, you know, getting the meal. And so it's complicated. You talk about the point of belief as if it's just to track the true. Why think that, though?
Right. Basically, because I think that then you can talk about belief as a system that's governed by rules that I like being consistent. So if you're aiming at the truth, then that explains maybe why you should be consistent. Because if you don't have consistent belief, then they can't all be right. So it's true that, you know, consistency is maybe not always something you care about. Like sometimes you're engaged in activity and it's not the only thing you care about. So playing chess is another example. So I gave humor as one example. The point of playing chess is to win at chess. If you're playing chess with, like, your 10-year-old cousin, and your 10-year-old cousin is rather sensitive, you might lose on purpose. So I don't think that the point of belief is the point of life.
Right. We've got John from Mountain View on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, John. What's your comment or question?
Yes. In his book, Techniques of Persuasion, the British philosopher J.A.C. Brown said two pretty scary things. He said, the will to believe is more powerful than any mere experience, and emotion is stronger than reason in the vast majority of people. How do your people feel about that?
So, Ray, how do you feel about that?
So let me make sure I've got the question. So one was, the will to believe is more powerful than any other
reason,
than any mere experience.
Any mere experience.
And emotion is stronger than reason in the vast majority of people.
Yeah. Right. So I think I would say probably yes, the will to believe is at least sometimes stronger than experience, because a lot of your beliefs go beyond any experience that you could have had.
Right.
So I think even my beliefs about mathematics and science are not just based on experience, because like I haven't seen an electron, but I believe those exist. And I haven't seen a number, but I believe not only that those exist, but that I like understand some properties of them. I'm less sure with electrons. So that might be a sort of not quite the point that you were getting at, but I think that experience alone is not a complete foundation for belief in the first place.
So, right. Quine talked about the web of belief. Mm-hmm. And so we got all these beliefs. And think of any experience that I have, and it offers me the possibility of a new belief. But whenever I adopt a new belief, I may have to make readjustments. So I think Trump is the most trustworthy person in the world. I hear him say something on television, and I have is he lying? No, wait a minute. He's the most trustworthy. Do I have to take back that he's the most trustworthy? Or is that reporter just a left-wing liberal, right? So, I mean, there's all kinds of it's not like the evidence speaks with a univocal voice, because, you know, there's this whole web of belief, to use Quine, and some of them I hold really dear.
And I think that maybe gets at John's point about this being scary. So if I get things wrong, I'd like to correct myself. And a natural way to correct myself, you might have thought, was experience. So if I'm wrong in my political beliefs, so like I don't think that Trump is a good president, and other people might disagree with me, but like if I'm wrong about that, I'd kind of like to know. And if any source that would tell me the truth is one that I would dismiss as unreliable, then I've got a problem, and that is scary.
What about conversation? It seems like, so experience could be a check on your bad beliefs and bad sort of habits of thinking. What about discussion, conversation, philosophy, refutation, you know, the kind of thing we're doing now? Is that a help, or do people have a way to sort of block out interfering thoughts and positions?
Yes, that is a help, and yes, people have a way to block out interfering thoughts and positions. So conversation can do a couple of different things for you. So it can tell you just facts that you didn't know before, that are facts that other people have found by their experience. So, you know, you have both lived in California longer than I have, and you know where some things in California are that I don't know where they are, and you can tell me. And so I can get just factual information. I can also get sort of arguments. So you can help me reason through by talking me through you know, where my argument went wrong. So if I'm going to be wrong on the internet, you can correct my reasoning.
Except yes, we could, but we could be jerks and liars and not trustworthy. And how do you know? So look, people like to appeal to the evidence. Let the evidence guide your beliefs. But what counts as evidence for what, right? I mean, it's relative to, I think it's all, the weight of the evidence is relative to things you already believe, right? So if I believe the flat earth theory, right, then I'll take the thing that disappears over the horizon as evidence that, well, it must have fallen off the earth, right? Not that the earth is round, because I already believe the flat earth theory. If I don't trust Josh, then I take him saying something as evidence that it's not so, right? Or might not be so, or something like that. So,
yeah, I think there are two kinds of risks, and you can't completely get rid of them. So one is that you are jerks. So if you lie to me about where things are, I'll just get lost. I'll trust you and I'll get lost, and there's nothing I can do to guarantee that you won't. And another possibility is that I'm a jerk and that you guys have lots of true things to tell me and I keep dismissing you because they don't fit with my preconceptions. And I don't think that I can guarantee that neither of those will happen, but I can try and mitigate my risk of them happening.
Dorothy from San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Dorothy. What's your comment or question?
I was wondering if you could discuss the difference between facts and truth. Facts can be manipulated. I'm thinking of how statistics can be manipulated, for example. Truth is, that includes like ethical truth, like the Golden Rule, and what I think of as metaphorical truth, the image of Mother Earth, for example, as an expression of, you know, the importance of, well, the environmental movement, for example.
Help me understand how you understand the difference between fact and truth, because I'm not.
Facts are, well, again, like statistics, like, you know, hard truth. You might say hard truth. Scientific truth, for example. That's still truth, but it's a particular type of truth. And again, it can be, I guess it was Disraeli said something about there are lies, damn lies, and statistics. And we can see statistics being manipulated to suit a particular, let's say, political stance. Truth, I think of as being rather broader and includes things that may not be quite so easily pinned down as, say, scientific truth, such as ethics and let's say poetical truth.
Okay, I think I've got you, Dorothy. I think. I want to turn that over to Ray. What do you think about? Thanks for the question, Dorothy.
Yeah, so I think that the distinction that you're providing is a real distinction, and that there are truths that aren't knowable by merely statistical or merely scientific means without like bad-mouthing statistics or science, because I think those things are great. And actually, even truths that you can sort of get at by statistical means, you can only get at sort of inexactly. So if you want to know whether a drug causes a side effect, that is a kind of question that's amenable to statistics. But even if you do your study properly, you could get sort of an accidental correlation between the drug and the apparent side effect, and you could get it wrong. So I think there's a difference between what is true, which might be difficult to access or impossible to access, and what your evidence suggests that you should believe.
I want to come back, if it's okay, to something you said earlier. It was a very compelling idea, which was that, okay, fair enough, there are useful beliefs out there that aren't true. But if you can get what you want and get it right, then so much the better. That seems an excellent principle for how to sort of sort out the difference between cases where we really should be sticking to the truth and cases where we're going to need something else. I'm thinking a little bit of William James's example of you're climbing and you get kind of stuck, there's no way back, and you've got to jump this crevasse. Right. The last thing you want to do is calculate your chances of survival. Just because I'm going to make this and jump. So how should we distinguish? Which are the cases? Is there any way to sort them out? Which are the cases where, you know what, yeah, there's no way of getting what you want and being self-honest?
Yes, so cases where you've got a lot of time are probably good cases for pausing to reflect and see at least whether you can end up with true beliefs.
Right.
Cases, so the crevasse case has like a time limit and high stakes. And so maybe there you're stuck not caring so much about getting the absolutely true belief and solving this immediate problem.
But something like climate change or political
opinions, you should
take all the time you need.
Some psychologists distinguish between kind of system one and system two, right? The kind of fast gut instinct, kind of system one is kind of this fast gut instinct, unreflective thing that we cognition in the wild, and it's fast and dirty and it's quick, but it's also kind of reliable, but it doesn't track the truth necessarily. And system two cognition is slow, laborious. Trump was a system one politician. Hillary Clinton is a system two, slow, ratiocination. I mean, both seem to have their place. I mean, we do both. Both seem to have their place.
And actually, I don't think it's quite fair to describe system one as not directed at the truth at all. So Josh just mentioned William James, and William James has this really useful thing to say about the aims of belief, which is that you kind of want to do two things and they're at odds. So you want to believe a lot of truths, but you want to avoid believing any falsehoods.
Right.
And if you believed everything, then you could achieve the aim of believing a lot of truths because they'd be in there somewhere. But you'd really fail at the aim of not believing a lot of falsehoods. And if you were skeptical about everything and believed nothing, then you'd succeed at the aim of not believing a lot of falsehoods.
But sometimes believing a falsehood has bad costs, but sometimes taking your turn time to believe the truth has greater costs. Right. So and sometimes you're better off believing the falsehood than doing the quick falsehood, the quick accessible falsehood, than the slow inaccessible truth.
Right. And also, if you just adopt a method where you form a lot of beliefs quickly, then you end up believing more truths than you would if you were careful, because you just believe more things than you would if you were careful.
Yes, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking whether belief should aim at truth with Ray Briggs from Stanford University.
Are there things we can do to make sure we're getting it right? What practical tips are out there to help us be better believers?
Lessons in believing the truth when Philosophy Talk continues. You may feel like you can fly, but if you truly believe it and you act on that belief, well, you might need a little medical attention. I'm Kent Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy, sitting in for John Perry. Our guest is Ray Briggs from Stanford University, and we're asking whether beliefs should aim at the truth.
And we've got a caller, Jay in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jay. What's your comment or question?
Hi. I guess whenever I hear the phrase useful belief, the first thing I think about is karma, and not in the sense of sort of, you know, multi-lifetime karma where something comes back in the next life, but just that sort of what goes around comes around kind of karma. And it strikes me as a belief that is useful because, for one thing, even if you get it wrong, it's, you know, still good to practice as if it were true. What do you think about that?
I'm not sure. What do you think about that, Ray?
So it does sound like a useful belief, and maybe a belief where you could get the same benefits without having a belief that it was true, but some other kind of attitude toward it. So you could, for instance, act as if it were true, and that might get you the same benefits.
So I have a problem. I would like to aim my beliefs at the truth. I would like to hit the truth and only the truth. Unlike Nietzsche, I don't think I'm afraid of the truth. I don't think truth would undermine my life, but would give me a realist.
You want to know what's going on in the restaurant, in the kitchen, when you're eating your meal?
I want to know so I don't have to go there.
But here's the thing. I think the truth is really hard, and I don't actually know how to aim. I mean, I open my eyes. The world assaults me with all kinds of beliefs. Okay, that's right. But, like, quarks and gluons, how do I, you know, I mean, Aristotle didn't know how to believe the truth about the fundamental constitution of the universe. Politics, gosh, all these people shouting, I don't know how to aim at the truth. So I want some practical advice from you on, like, how do I go about following your directive, believe the truth? How do I do that?
So I think philosophy does have some helpful tools here. And one of the helpful tools is examining your reasons for the things that you believe and seeing whether they're good reasons. So you could accidentally believe the truth without having any good reasons, but having good reasons sort of supports the hypothesis that what you believe is in fact the truth. So checking carefully whether your arguments for the things that you believe are good and asking yourself about the evidence is one strategy. I know that's a little vague, so let me...
Yeah, I know. You could be more precise, and I understand that you could be more precise. But, you know, if a good argument is an argument I find moving, and I found this argument moving, what good is it going to do? I want to check again? I was like, oh, I'm going to consider that again. Does it move me again? Yep.
Yeah, there are better ways to do it than that, I think.
Okay, so, good. I hope so.
Yeah, so one way is to take up the opposite view. Assume that your job is to look for holes in your argument and sort of fashion yourself as an opponent of your view. And then if there are holes in your argument, you're more likely to find them by looking for them than by assuming that they're not there or just going through the argument again.
Can you do this yourself, or is it more helpful to have a buddy? Like, you know, surround yourself with people who maybe don't share all of your beliefs.
I think both of those things are helpful. So having a buddy who really doesn't share all of your beliefs will ensure that the person who's behaving like an opponent is really doing a good job because they want to. And maybe you don't want to do such a good job explaining why your own views are false.
Right. You lack the sufficient motivation.
So we got Joe. Oh, this is a Joanne in San Francisco asks, in this era of fake news and alternate facts, are we entering a new period where the truth doesn't really matter? And do Donald Trump and his allies benefit when people are confused and can't tell the difference between the true and the false? Isn't that confusion useful for them?
I think that confusion is useful for them. I want to say the truth really matters still, because it matters to me. Yeah, so what else can I say about this? So if you don't want people to believe the truth, then you can benefit from sort of spreading falsehoods really loudly. People do believe those in their environment.
And so you're suggesting another reason why your belief should aim at the truth, to protect you from all those jerks out there who manipulate you and deceive you and use you and then spit you out. So it's not just because believing... You made it sound as if believing the truth is just intrinsically good, and maybe it is, but it's also it's useful for surviving in a world of manipulative others.
I think it is. So there might be some environments where believing falsehoods is useful to you, but there are also a lot of environments where believing falsehoods is detrimental to you.
I totally agree. You know, Usain Bolt aside, there are a lot of things that's very important to know. But one question I have is, do you think that there's been any contribution to this sort of our current environment where we seem to be in an era where more people are believing things that aren't quite right? Was there any contribution from the world of philosophy to this, or are our hands clean, so to speak?
I think our hands are probably not clean, and there are philosophers across the political spectrum who believe sort of simple-minded theories on which there is no such thing as truth, or skeptical theories where there might be a truth, but you'll never be able to get at it, so why bother?
Yeah, I know why you asked that question, because as a comp lit guy, even though you're literature and philosophy, but as the comp lit part of you, your tribe is highly responsible for the diminishment in our confidence of the truth, or that truth is just
totally
power.
Agree.
Or, you know.
I totally agree.
Yeah. But we've got a caller, Bill from Daly City. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Bill.
Oh, thank you. Other than the things that are believed, is there really any difference between faith and superstition?
Well, they're both bad ways of believing. Well, maybe. I don't know. What do you think? Is faith a good way of believing? Is faith better than superstition?
I think people use the word faith in a lot of different ways, and sometimes it gets used to refer to things that are basically superstition. Some people also use the word faith to refer to things that you believe that you don't have much evidence based on experience to believe, but you might nonetheless have a good reason to believe. So beliefs about morality like so that it is wrong to wantonly torture kittens for right. fun. I don't think that you can exactly observe that to be true. Like if you look at somebody torturing kittens, I don't know why you would want to do that. Well, to observe whether it's wrong. You wouldn't see the wrongness. You'd sort of see the pathetic meowing sounds of the kittens, and you'd see their furriness. And the wrongness wouldn't be directly observable. But it looks like you can know that that's wrong. And it's by some other method than just scientific observation. So some people call that faith. And I think there are such methods.
Well, right. I don't think it's at all true that science, I love science. I think science is really cool. It's the big cognitive kahuna. It's the biggest deal that we... But it's not the only way of arriving at belief, right? And it's not the only way of arriving at confident belief. I mean, most of my political beliefs are not arrived at through scientific investigation. It's
but they're not incompatible with what we...
That's true.
Science.
But they're not rooted in right. science either. Right. So there must be sources of believing other than observation and experiment.
I agree. So reasoning looks like... Most of my mathematical beliefs are not got by observing objects. Like I'm more of a fan of the idea that you can learn about mathematics by observing objects than many philosophers. So I think like you can learn about the natural numbers by putting things together and counting them. But I don't know, the stuff I know about linear algebra, that it doesn't look like I observed any object that taught me that.
So far, we've been talking about how to make ourselves better believers, but here's maybe the big question. How do we get other, is it even possible? Can we tempt other people? Can we cajole other people? You've spent all this time on the internet, you confessed, trying to do this. Fruitlessly, right. Is there any way? You have any tips for us?
Yeah, so there's, I think there are always going to be people that you cannot persuade because either they, usually because they have no reason to listen to you. So debate can be of limited usefulness against the person you're debating with, mm-hmm. if what they want is not actually to check whether they're wrong, but to show that they're right. Debate can help an audience.
Yeah.
So, and selecting people who already want to get at the truth but don't know how.
But I want to add something though, because I think we're being the Josh's friends from CompLit. Mm-hmm. I think have a deep point that we need to look. People's belief. Have you ever known a privileged person who did not think their privilege was deserved? Have you ever known?
Yes.
Have you ever known? I haven't known too many. Have you ever known a person at the bottom of a hierarchy who did not think that their place at the bottom of the hierarchy was undeserved? People have beliefs that put themselves in the best light, right? So they're not. People aren't inveterate truth seekers. We're just not. We're inveterate self-justifiers. And so to argue with somebody, how do you break through that cocoon of self-justification?
You can't always. I think what you can do is sort of on the margins, sort of find doubt and talk to people with doubts and sort of ideally collaboratively help them investigate those doubts.
What do you think about the power of testimony? I mean, there was some studies which were then retracted but then redone, and it seems like maybe there's some evidence to suggest that sharing experiences with people at a kind of personal level, an emotional level, might actually make a difference where arguments might not.
Right. So actually, I haven't kept up with those studies since they were retracted, because that guy just kind of made up his data
right.
wholesale.
Yeah. But then they redid them, and it seems like maybe there's still something there.
Right. So I think I would have to look at the studies and think about them to see whether I believed that conclusion. It sounds plausible to me.
But there is a friend of mine, an artist friend of mine, a music engineer guy that I just met recently, says, get people to reason together. Get them making things together. Because first get them in deep sympathy with one another. Mm. Get them sharing experiences. And then they will share a commitment to truth. And that you philosophers who think you come in with your abstract commitment to truth, right, from on high and from outside, we're just barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, I don't think that those things are incompatible. Like, I think that the tools of philosophy can be used in a collaborative way. And they can also be used in a sort of self-critical way. So, like, I think that those tools are most useful to me when I'm trying to figure out for myself what the truth is and whether my reasons for the beliefs I have are good reasons or whether I'm just tricking myself.
Well, on that note, Ray, I'm going to thank you for joining. This has been a great conversation. We've only scratched the surface. I don't know if we've made everybody a seeker of the truth, but we gave it a college try. So thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Our guest has been Ray Briggs. She's a professor of philosophy from Stanford University. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from someone who will always sacrifice the truth for his belief in speed, the Usain Bolt of philosophy, Ian Scholes.
Ian Scholes, there's an appreciation of the Grateful Dead in the Wall Street Journal on the anniversary of a legendary performance, 5877, at Cornell, where writer Andy Kessler was a student at the time. He believes the Dead foreshadowed the sharing economy because of the fan practice of taping and swapping shows and cassette. That's like Uber, I guess, if cassettes were cars and you paid them to take you across town to a really cool bar you heard about once. Anyway, this Kessler guy seems to think that because he likes the Dead, as do right-wingers Steve Bannon and Ann Coulter, the Dead is not really a hippie band. That's fake news. It's a false belief. Well, I don't know. You got trickle-down economics on the one hand. You got karma will kill you in the end on the other. Well, they're both the same thing, aren't they? They're both stupid hippie notions we believe and not believe at the same time. Actions used to be based on a core belief, the rock on which we stand. The water's got shallow and murky, and it's hard to see that rock, so beliefs have been replaced by belief systems. It's the PowerPoint version of the Ten Commandments. It's tailored to the room, a pie chart which we all share. Each of us has a tiny sliver of pie on it somewhere, and that sliver is what keeps us from civil war. Now, some claim there's a war on faith, which has led to a defense of what is called religious liberty. Not the same as freedom. If you take a liberty, liberty's not lost. You're kissing somebody without permission. So if you take the liberty, you get the kiss, and the person you kissed is left with a burning cheek and grounds for an assault charge, unless a president comes along with an executive order saying he can kiss you if he wants because he's a preacher. Religious liberty means liberty is taken not by Christians, but gay couples who dare to ask for a wedding cake. Cheeky for sure, but I'm not seeing whose beliefs are being challenged here. There are people who don't believe in abortion, who don't want to have an insurance policy that pays for contraception, which they don't use, but how does their belief about insurance ethics trump mine, which is the deeply held belief that we should get whatever insurance we can before Congress votes again? Even if you do have strong beliefs, can't you just not bake a cake for lesbians and shut up about it? Not sure what hill these believers believe they're dying on, especially since they're not on a hill, they're on the same level playing field, and nobody's shooting at them. That's my belief. Anyway, in May, President Trump issued a religious liberty executive order, an order supposed to topple the Johnson Amendment, which allows the IRS to take away the tax-exempt status of churches if they start stumping for candidates in the pulpit. But hold on, evangelicals have not been shy about their beliefs. Even as Trump's executive order was being drafted or scribbled on a piece of paper, noted preacher Pat Robertson said people who oppose Trump are revolting against God. Did he get audited? Don't believe so. Anyway, after the signing of this thingy, the ACLU, which had threatened to sue, read it, I guess, and changed his mind because the order didn't really change anything. It was just a lip service photo op suck up to the conservative base. The Johnson Amendment remains in place, largely ignored. Atheists are still self-righteous. Evangelicals are still whining about the war and Christmas. And President Trump remains about as religious as I am, though I am grateful that, thanks to this bland order, a megachurch in the future will be free to endorse Satan himself for president without repercussion. It is free to take that liberty. It is part of the consequences of our belief system, and belief itself has nothing to do with it. On the other hand, sorry Ann Coulter, sorry Wall Street Journal, believe what you want, but if you're hippie dancing to a jam band, you are, in fact, a hippie. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Yes, he believes that we pray to a giant frog god named Gort. And who are you to say that Gort is not God?
Right, right.
This is the president's belief.